Baron had clearly been concerned his messages might be intercepted, and he'd chosen his words carefully. It wasn't the first time Holston had been compelled to interpret the true meaning in a message, but he'd realized almost instantly that this one was critically important, worth all the extra care he could give it. Tyler Baron was convinced. The others, as the hegemony somewhat mysteriously called this new enemy, were a threat to the Rim. A deadly threat. There weren't many people whose opinions Holston believed immediately without evidence or his own analysis, but Tyler Baron was a member of that exclusive club. Baron had been on the front lines of the war with the hegemony. He'd seen his spacers killed in vast numbers. He'd lost friends, too, longtime comrades like Sarah Eaton. It had to be killing Baron somewhere deep inside to urge the Confederation authorities to intervene, to join forces with their recent enemy. And that's exactly what Baron was doing in the message, even if it took a bit of interpretation to see it. Baron's lack of directness, and the Admiral was normally one of the most straightforward people the Spymaster had ever known, meant only one thing. Baron was concerned about the Senate. There weren't many worlds in the Confederation clamoring for another war, of course, not for the ruinous taxation that paid for it. The politicians would be extremely reluctant to vote for any commitment to a new conflict so soon after the truce with the hegemony. He didn't even want to think about how the senators would react to a request that they not only support a new war far from home, but that they do it to aid the hated hegemony, still the enemy in the minds of most Confederation citizens. They don't realize it's also the last thing Tyler Baron wants to do. If he's suggesting it, and he is, it's a damn certainty there's no other choice. The situation Corward had to be critical, and the one threat that loomed over the Rim as well as the hegemony. Holston didn't hesitate. Didn't even think about it. Baron's word was enough for him. His contributions on the battlefront would be minimal. He didn't know anything about this new enemy, and he certainly didn't have intelligence assets placed to provide any useful information. Except in the Senate. That was where he could help. Baron needed votes. He needed authorization to commit his forces, and for the rest of the fleet to be mobilized and sent to his aid. That won't be easy. But nothing worthwhile was easy. Holston turned toward his main workstation and began typing. It was time to pull up his black files again. All the dirt he had on the men and women of the Senate, the deepest and darkest secrets he'd gathered on the rogues and scoundrels who ran the Confederation. It was time to use all of that. Time to speak in a language corrupt politicians understood. Threats. And he stared at the screen, tears pouring down her cheeks. Tyler's message to her had been sweet, loving, and full of his best efforts to reassure her. And then he'd told her what was happening. Another war. She tried not to get ahead of herself. The Confederation wasn't at war again, not yet. But she was too experienced, too much a veteran to give credence to baseless optimism. Tyler had not gone Corward to find an excuse to aid the hegemony. To the contrary, he was utterly certain he would have loved nothing more than watching the Confederation's recent enemy fall before some unstoppable foe. As long as he believed that force would stop there, that it would not continue on to the Rim. Clearly, he did believe the hegemony's enemy was a threat to the Confederation, and she trusted him enough to take his word as fact. She'd had a knee-jerk reaction, and she'd almost fired up the comm to call the shipyard and tell them to get Pegasus ready to go. Every fiber of her being cried out to her to go to Tyler, to stand at his side, to fight next to the only man she had ever loved. Then reality struck hard. It wasn't possible. Travel through transit points was dangerous to developing children, and she was past the point that allowed interstellar travel. She didn't have many choices just then. Staying behind, sitting and waiting, for news of victory or defeat. For that fateful communique that told her Tyler Baron's luck in battle had run out, that he'd been killed somewhere, almost unimaginably far from home. It was inconceivable for her to stay where she was, but anything else risked her child. Tyler's child. She could have disregarded any danger to herself to go to his side. But she couldn't risk their baby. Her head pounded and she put her face forward, cradling it in her hands. She was frustrated, scared, heartbroken. She was no fool. Though sometimes she wondered if life as one wouldn't sometimes be easier. She knew what the situation meant. Tyler was already there, hundreds of light years Corward, facing a deadly new danger. If the Senate did as he asked, if it committed the Confederation to a new war, sent the fleet to the front lines, it would be years before Tyler returned to Megara, if he ever did. For an instant, against all logic, she hoped the Senate would refuse. But the solace only lasted a few seconds. No, she realized, that would be worse. She knew Tyler too well. If he believed the enemy was a threat to the Rim, he would act with whatever he had. And without the rest of the fleet, he would have only the task force he'd led to the hegemony capital. It was a powerful force by any measure, save by comparison to the entire fleet. The thought of him fighting with such limited resources, facing an even greater chance of failure, of death, was too much. There had to be something she could do, some way to help him. But there wasn't. There was nothing at all. She sat still, unmoving, and she lost all track of time. Then the frustration overwhelmed her. She had no options, no way to help. So she did something she almost never did, something she would have ridiculed others for doing. She sat there, and she cried. Chapter 26 Planet Calphuron, Sigma Nordlund 4, Year of Renewal 267, 322 AC. Kronos, I just wanted to say. Akella's words, soft when she'd started, slipped into total silence. I know, Akella. I know. Kronos knew what she was trying to say, and he knew how difficult it was. The hegemony was a society based on individualism above all things. Men and women could be friends, of course, or comrades, but each member of the ordered society, and especially the masters at the top, were expected to exist on their own. They had duties, and all shared a stake in the sacred obligation to shepherd humanity, to guide it away from another decline, or pull it from the continued slide, depending on the theories to which one subscribed. But relationships were limited, based on shared interests or obligations, or on mutually satisfactory recreational sex. But mating decisions were expected to be purely rational, and hegemony society had no equivalent of the pair bonding so common in other cultures. Akella had conceived her first child with Thantor, a man she'd never much liked, and one who had become her greatest rival. But the pressure for the first and second highest rated human beings in the hegemony to combine their DNA had been irresistible. I feel the same. It was as much as he would say, as much as he could say. He knew he'd allowed his affection for Akella to progress beyond what was allowed, especially for 2 top 10 ranked masters, and he was almost certain she shared his feelings. He didn't know what that meant, long-term, if there even was a long-term. But there was no time for it now and no place for the controversy that would erupt if anyone else found out about it. He'd been able to disguise his visits to see Akella as trips to see the child the two of them shared, and that would have to hold for the time being. Be careful out there. Kronos could see from her expression. She felt foolish even as the words came out. They both knew the hegemony was fighting for survival. There was no room for caution, no sacrifice too great to make in the pursuit of victory. Kronos had never been one to leave for war feeling he wouldn't return, but as he stood there and let his thoughts drift forward, there was only darkness. But he needed something better than that to tell Akella. If the words he was about to speak were to be the last between them, he would say something she could bear to remember, and not just warnings of grim darkness. Take care of yourself, Akella. Watch the council. Without me here, you're one ally down. And Thantor is a snake. You're smarter than he is, but don't take your eyes off of him. Not for a second. I won't. I know what Thantor is. He leaned forward and kissed her. He hadn't intended to do it, but his impulses took control. And he could feel her responding, her arms slipping around his back. He couldn't do anything so primitive as tell her he loved her, that they would be together when, if, he returned. He knew that wasn't possible, not for them. But for a few seconds, perhaps half a minute, he cast aside the obligations of a hegemony master, the concerns of the supreme military commander. For those fleeting seconds, he felt only what he wanted to feel. Then he pulled slowly back, his eyes locked with hers for an instant, one last bit of silent communication. Then he turned slowly, and he was gone. Off to face the others, and very likely to his own death. All ships report ready, Admiral. The fleet is prepared to depart on your command. Baron glanced over at Travis, acknowledging her report with a nod. His ships were ready, the morale of his crews better than he could possibly have expected. He knew his deeds had won him some of that, the respect and confidence of his spacers, and his grandfather's exploits contributed as well, the family name that carried so much weight with the Confederation's military. It was also ignorance, he knew. The rank and file of the fleet had no doubt seethed with resentment and anger toward the hegemony, but they hadn't seen the footage he and the senior officers had, the scanner data showing the others' vessels cutting through the hegemony ships like cordwood, the vessels that had so battered their own ships, that had seemed so invincible when they had faced them in desperate combat. Bairn didn't like hiding things from his crew, but his people were far from home and no doubt confused about why they had come so far into what they still regarded as enemy territory. He didn't need to test the limits of their endurance, not until there was no choice. Admiral, I have Commander Kronos on your line.
Put him through.
Bairn tapped the side of his headset. Commander. Admiral Bairn, I wish to thank you for your decision to join our forces in Pharsalon. Even if you are barred from combat, it will only serve to reinforce your conviction that we do indeed face a mutual and deadly adversary. That is my belief, Commander. I have already requested that my government authorize my forces to engage the others, and that reinforcements be sent at once. While I am hopeful the Senate will heed my warning, a lie or close to it. Bairn rarely expected anything but grief from the politicians. It can only help if I am able to send additional evidence, this time collected by my own people. Bairn felt a brief concern about his words. He hadn't intended to suggest that he still doubted the hegemony provided data, but he suspected Kronos understood. He imagined his hegemony counterpart would feel much the same about the Senate as he did, and completely understand the difficulties Bairn faced dealing with them. I fear you will see more than you could wish for, Admiral. All reports suggest the enemy forces have massed, and that a large fleet is advancing on Pharsalon even now. We should arrive before them with luck, but not by long. You will very likely get a first-hand view of the enemy's combat power, as will I. This will be my first time facing them myself. Good fortune to you, Commander Kronos. That is what my people wish to each other on the eve of battle. Good fortune to you as well, Admiral, in this campaign and in whatever follows. Bairn cut the line. He was beginning to respect Kronos, even to like the hegemony commander, and part of what lived inside hated himself for it, just as it did for his growing friendship was the only word that came to mind, with Akella. Admiral Travis, our rules of engagement require us to avoid contact with the enemy, but our mission is to gather as much information as possible. So while we will not be joining the hegemony forces in their fight, I want every vessel ready for action at all times. That means rotating duty squadrons on alert, all systems maintained for combat operations, and scanners on full power at all times.
Yes, Admiral. Understood.
Bairn almost laughed. His order was for the benefit of the officers on the bridge. He and Atara had already discussed all of that, and she'd issued the necessary orders. If anything, his second-in-command was more hawkish than he was. In an odd contradiction, Atara both retained more animosity toward the hegemony and exhibited more drive to engage the new enemy as well. She'd never been one for half measures. The fleet was ready, for whatever happened in the coming days. But that readiness was largely wasted. Bairn's rules of engagement shackled him, prevented him from intervening. He knew what he could do, and he was coldly aware of how inadequate it was. Hold back and watch. And if the enemy approached, to run. The thought of fleeing sickened him, and if a small part of him still felt the hegemony was only getting what it deserved, it went against everything that made him who he was to run and leave the others to their doom. He wasn't sure how he'd do it when the need came, which it almost certainly would. But he had a little time to find a way, to dig up the resolve to go against his every impulse and instinct. We're operating under restrictions that limit the Admiral's options should he encounter any enemy ships. Stockton had been fishing around for a way to refer to the others. They weren't the Confederation's enemy, at least not officially, not yet. And though he knew the truce had been signed and ratified by all nations involved in the recent war, his instinct was still to think of the hegemony as the enemy. That is a reality Admiral Bairn will have to deal with, but for us it is far simpler. All we have to do is follow whatever orders it gives us. That brings me to my point. We must be ready to do whatever we are ordered to do, up to and including defending the fleet against an enemy about which we know almost nothing. That means full wartime footing, maximum patrols, exercises whenever the fleet stops or maintains constant thrust levels long enough. I know you've just gotten used to the idea of peace, but from the looks of things, you can forget that right now. I've let you all loosen up a little. Figured you'd earned it after the last 6 years. But that's officially over right now, so consider my foot back on all of your necks, effective immediately. Stockton was standing on Dauntless's flight deck, addressing the flagship's combined fighter wing. Behind the pilots, in serried ranks, lay their fighters, neat and clean and perfectly aligned in parallel rows. The deck and the Lightning fighter stowed down its length looked better than he could remember, cleaner and neater than they ever had during the war. The pilots and their flight crews had enjoyed a year without combats, without klaxons sounding and scramble orders reverberating from the comm speakers down in fighter country. The maintenance crews had used that free time to reorder their domain, and the flight deck looked almost like new. The pilots, to Stockton's dismay, if not his surprise. "You would have done no differently when you were their age," had gone the other way. The razor-sharp instrument he'd created had dulled a bit, and it needed to be rehoned, restored to the deadly weapon of war it had been not long ago. Stockton stared out at the 86 officers assembled, 74 fighter jocks and a dozen shuttle pilots. But even as his eyes panned over them, he knew the squadrons on the other battleships were similarly formed up, watching on their comm displays as the fleet's flight commander handed down the new realities. The message left no room for doubt, and no one who had come up under Stockton's leadership, almost everyone present, had the slightest doubt he meant what he said. They'd heard stories, of course, of the wild young pilot, with a loose interpretation of what following orders meant. They'd probably even heard a few of the old veterans, the handful who'd survived so many years of war, tell stories of desperate fights in the depths of space and poker games in the officers' clubs of the fleet. But all the younger pilots knew was the grim legend they saw before them, a man forged by loss and pain from the clay of that wild and talented young pilot into the hardened alloy of an admiral who had led the squadrons to victory over the hegemony invaders. Stockton stood for a moment, silent, mildly amused at the collective, as a partially restrained groan went up from Dauntless's pilots. They'd gotten used to fewer flight hours and less intense discipline, and they were beginning to realize that was all over. Stockton didn't know if his pilots were going to war again. That wasn't his call. It was his job to make sure they were ready, ready for whatever Admiral Barron needed of them. And nothing was going to stand in the way of that. Nothing that didn't want to be obliterated by his unstoppable stubbornness and determination. Ilya sat in his sanctum, relishing the silence, and even more the solitude. He'd always enjoyed his time alone, and he often sat for hours, thinking, meditating. But this was different. It wasn't the allure of silent hours of unobstructed thought that had pulled him from the bridge into his private domain. He wasn't escaping noise or the beehive of activity of the ship's main control center. He was hiding. Ilias had long prided himself on his honesty, above all with himself. He'd always been able to keenly analyze his own weaknesses and work to improve on them. It had been some years into his adulthood before he'd realized just how rare a trait that was. But now it was failing him. He was in his sanctum because he was afraid, and he was trying to hide that from his staff and his crew. Ilias was a combat veteran, with a flawless record. He'd been decorated for both skill and bravery multiple times, and he was a master of high, if not council-level, rating. But since he'd returned from his second encounter with the others, something had been different. The grim and relentless power that drove him seemed stalled, and every thought of engaging the enemy again, what would be his third encounter with the others, shook him ever more deeply. He'd managed to disguise it while he was on the bridge, but he'd come back to the sanctum to focus, to meditate, and open the depths of his mind, to regain his power over the fear that was gradually taking control of him. He'd always considered himself a creature of logic, of rational thought, and that had carried him through the many dangers he'd faced in his military career. But there was something different about the others, something that overcame his reason, that reached down to a place deep inside where his darkest fears lived. He was determined to drive the force from within him, to regain his cold and analytical view of things. "The others are only an enemy, like many you have fought. Stronger, perhaps, more advanced. But only an enemy, nevertheless." He continued the mantra, an almost silent speech as well as thought, repeating it again and again, willing his mind to accept his reassertion of control. He pushed away the doubts, though they quickly returned, as some enemy throwing itself at his defenses. "You are above this. You control your emotions, your thoughts, your fear. This is the fight you were born for, the battle you have been trying to fight all your life. You will not be defeated by fear, crushed before the final fight even begins." He believed all that he was telling himself some of the time, and then the doubts and terror renewed their seemingly relentless assaults. Chapter 27. Senate Compound, destroy a city. Megara, Oleus 3. Year 322 AC. With all due respect to our esteemed Admiral Baron, I strongly urge caution on any action of this sort. It has been barely a year since we signed the truce ending the war with the hegemony, and the Admiral would now have us rush to their aid. Not just provide financial support or limited military intervention, but to mobilize the entire fleet, to send it dozens of ships from Confederation territory to the barely known Corward depths. Tyler Baron is a hero of the Confederation, and no one can take that from him. But he is not a diplomat, and he does not have the experience to negotiate alliances with former enemies. I move that we send a Blue Ribbon Task Force to Calphoron to examine the situation firsthand, and to negotiate directly with the hegemony leaders before reporting back to this body. Kettle Vaughn was the leader of the Greens, one of the two political parties dominating politics on the worlds of the Iron Belt. The Greens and their counterparts, the Reds, agreed almost universally in their support for strong industrial policy, and on virtually nothing else. With all due respect to my esteemed colleague, Cinnavaria stood up and glared across the Senate floor at Vaughn. Avaria was the leader of the Reds, the longtime controlling party in the Iron Belt, but currently the opposition from those industrial powerhouse worlds by the razor-slim margin of a single seat. It is not only foolish and ignorant, but also an astonishing display of ingratitude to so easily disregard the Admiral's warning and his requests. No one wants war, of course, but few citizens have worked and fought and bled as much to protect the Confederation as Tyler Baron has. I demand we debate the merits of his request here and now, and not simply defer the matter to a group of appointees chosen from Senator Vaughn's cronies. The Senate erupted into shouts and sharp arguments, back and forth between individuals and small groups. Andy looked on, watching, getting angrier with every passing moment. She could feel Gary Holston's hand on her arm, his grip tightening. Next to Tyler, and of course her old crew from Pegasus, no one knew her better than the Confederation spymaster, or had a better read on when she was about to lose her temper. She'd had to tell Holston about the pregnancy, and now that she'd ventured out in public, showing beyond her ability to hide it, there was little doubt the word would spread. Andy had spent her life in the shadows, prowling around the Badlands and selling her wares mostly in black markets, hidden in dingy rooms behind taverns and stores that served as fronts. Her contacts and associates in those days had been even more averse to publicity than she was. That had all changed. She'd gathered considerable fame herself in recent years, courtesy of her exploits. But her marriage to the Confederation's greatest hero had thrust her into a level of scrutiny that made her skin crawl. She'd have walked into hell if that was the only way to stay by Tyler's side, and standing along the gallery over the Senate floor, that's about where she felt like she was. And he wasn't sure who made her angrier. Vaughn arguing that Baron was a fool or a liar and not to be believed when he warned about the threat he discovered, or Avaria playing the role of his ally when she was more concerned about feeding fresh military orders to the idled factories all around the belt and enriching the already grotesquely wealthy oligarchs who backed and ran the Red Party. What are we going to do, Gary? I don't care what these fools say, we've got to help Tyler. If he says there's a threat, I believe him. We can't just leave him out there with no support. I believe him too, Andy, but if you mean what I think you mean, the Senate compound is absolutely worst place to discuss it. Let's wait and see. The Senate is far from dependable, but Tyler and the Navy do have allies down there, and there are others who will want to assume the role of defenders of the Confederation. Tyler's a hero. His name is known everywhere, from Megara to the dustiest mining colony on the fringe. If they do not vote to send the fleet, we have options. Some of them far less extreme than others. I know you're worried about him, Andy, and your condition isn't helping your nerves, but we can't rush this. The last thing Tyler would want for us is to try to... He looked around and then lowered his voice. Do what you're thinking. At least not until we have other options. Andy knew Holston was right, at least about what Tyler would want. In spite of all he'd seen, the corruption, the pure foulness of the Confederation's government so often displayed, he remained at heart a believer. He'd been forced to challenge the Senate before, to take things to the verge of armed mutiny. But he bore terrible guilt for those actions, and he tried every way possible to avoid a repeat of anything of the sort. And he felt differently. Completely. She had no respect for the Senate, none whatsoever, nor for that matter any segment of the government. She'd made payoffs, bought her way out of inspections and out of trouble, seen the putrid underside of the whole creaking machine. She was prepared to line every senator against the wall if that's what it took to help Tyler, and she was ready to bet she could find the Marines ready to do it. All she'd have to do was show them Tyler's message, and maybe add a few tears. We'll talk later in more detail, but remember I have some influence in the chamber. My files are a bit thinner than they once were, perhaps, but there are quite a number of things some of our esteemed senators would prefer remained under a top-secret ban. Such things have a way of leaking sometimes, especially when people are uncooperative. Ulston's voice sounded calm and pleasant, but Andy could hear the sinister tone, hidden to most, but clear to her ears. And she loved every bit of it. Fleet exercises by whose command? By my command, Captain. Do you have a problem with that? Clint Winters' voice, his very tone defied anyone to answer that question in the affirmative. No, Admiral, of course not. It's just that, well, so soon after the war, I just thought... You thought the lesson of the conflict we just fought and barely survived was to allow our forces' readiness to atrophy? No, Admiral, of course not, but we still have a large number of people on extended leave, and... All leaves are canceled, Captain, effective immediately. We may be at peace again, but the Navy is still a military organization and discipline is paramount. You will issue the orders I have given you, and you will personally see that all personnel on leave are recalled to their posts without further delay, or I will find someone else to do it. Your chief aide, perhaps. That will not be necessary, Admiral. A pause. But this list of ships, it's almost 80% of the entire fleet. Are you sure it is wise to commit such a large percentage of our available strength to war games? We'll be pulling forces in from everywhere, even the unit stationed to defend Colossus. Do you think I would have ordered it if I didn't believe it was wise? Do you think I'm a fool, Captain? No, Admiral, certainly not. I will see to this at once, but at the very least, we will need senatorial approval to redeploy the new home fleet units to... Danith? The games are to be held around Danith? It would be much easier to assemble the forces someplace closer to the core, or even the Iron Belt. Do I seem like ease is my primary consideration, Captain? Perhaps the decay is worse than I thought. Where did the hegemony come from? Where is our next conflict likely to arise? We live in a changed reality now, with billions of humans living far coreward where we long believed no one had survived. What location could be better for military preparation exercises than the location most likely to be attacked one day? You're right, of course, Admiral. I will dispatch the fleet orders immediately, except for the specified home fleet units, of course. I will see to those personally as soon as we have authorization from the Senate. Very well, Captain. Winters almost argued further, but it would be too suspicious if he ordered the officer to disregard Senate directives, to in effect commit treason. And the last thing he needed was to make a lot of noise about the whole thing. He needed the Senate watching what he was doing like he needed two heads. Or two of a few other things. Besides, maybe Gary Holston can help with this, a bit more quietly than you can. Anya Fritz stared at the screen, her face emotionless for a few seconds, before a wide grin spread across her cheeks, and a laugh even escaped her lips. There were those in the Confederation service, a good number of them, who would have sworn the normally grim and serious engineer had never shown the slightest sign of amusement at anything. But those who knew her well, like Tyler Barron, realized she had quite a strong sense of humor, if a sophisticated one with somewhat of a slow burn. Barron's words still floated in her mind. I know the last thing you want or think you need is a group of hegemony technicians telling you what to do, but I went to a lot of trouble to get them sent to you, so I would consider it a personal favor if you would be nice and diplomatic while you're draining them dry of any useful information. Also, by all means, please try to send them back whole, with none of them having seen the business end of an airlock. Fritz nodded at how well Barron knew her, how he'd seen her reaction weeks before she'd had it. Still, it was hard to hold back the resentment, to accept that anyone could help her, speed her efforts to get Colossus up and running with a Confederation crew. At least until she heard Barron's next words. Anya, I'm afraid I'm in big trouble out here. This new enemy is real, and from what I've seen, in my gut, I think we're going to have to join the fight, however much it sickens us to stand alongside the hegemony. I don't know if we can defeat the enemy, even if the Senate does as I ask and send the entire fleet. We need Colossus, Anya. I need Colossus. You know I have absolute confidence in you and your work, but on your own, you'll need to discover all kinds of things the hegemony techs already know. Bleed them for information. Use them to get what you need for Colossus and for our overall technological development, and know you're doing it for the Confederation. And because I asked you. Because I need you to do it. Fritz felt her doubts and resentments slip away, and she suddenly realized the threat Barron had gone to investigate was real. Another war was coming, more death and destruction, and Baron needed her help as he had so many times before, no less at that moment than in all those other instances, when he'd been on the bridge and she down in engineering, frantically struggling to restore power or get engines back online. She watched the rest of the message, and then she tapped at the comm unit, calling up Eric Calmet. Yes, Commodore?
Eric, I know it's one of your all-too-rare off-duty periods, but I'm afraid I need you now. Assemble the rest of the department heads and meet me down in Landing Bay 12. We've got visitors coming. Important visitors.
Yes, Commodore. I'll take care of it immediately.
And Eric?
Yes, Commodore?
Advise the others I expect the very best behavior from every one of them, no matter what they see or hear. These guests will be controversial, but no one will be anything but utterly courteous and respectful. Is that understood?
Understood, Commodore. The officer's voice was close to normal, but Fritz could pick up something different, a combination of concern and curiosity. She almost explained, but then she held her tongue.
Let them all find out together. And Eric? Tell them all, if they've ever been scared of me, now is the time they should be, if any of them acts like anything other than exemplary officers of the Confederation.
Chapter 28 HWS Leonidor, Orbiting Planet Pharsalon, Itara Mordlin 3, Year of Renewal 267, 322 AC. The Battle of Pharsalon, Prelude. Kronos stared at the display, at the large blue and white sphere covering more than half of the screen. Pharsalon was the third planet in the system, a pleasant enough world, one covered almost 90% by a single massive ocean. Its inhabitants lived on two small continents, each surrounded by archipelagos of hundreds of tiny islands. Its population was small for a world this far into hegemony space, just under 300 million. It produced a number of valuable products and was, by all reasonable standards, a prosperous world. It was also irrelevant, and neither its quarter billion people nor the bounty of its seas had played any part at all in the tactical decision to attempt to hold the line there. Itara Mordlin III would have been sacrificed without hesitation, though Kronos would have added the guilt for its hundreds of millions to the stockpile building in the back of his mind. The fleet was there for another reason, one far more material, but also more important than a few hundred million lives, at least in the context of the war effort. Itara Mordlin VII was nothing like Pharsalon. Its dark and pitted surface was ugly, its atmosphere thick and caustic. It was hot, a raging inferno, despite its significant distance from the star it orbited. The planet was a textbook demonstration of out-of-control volcanic activity, and all across its scarred surface, rivers of molten rock flowed almost like water. Poisonous steam billowed out of cracks in the ground, and the shifting of its unstable continental plates caused tremors 100 times more severe than the most catastrophic quakes seen on a more typical world. It was a manifestation of hell, an image close to that depicted by artists of some fiery pit for the doomed. But it was one of the most valuable places in the hegemony. Itara Mordlin VII, it had a number of informal names, but nothing official, save the military designation AM-1, had the distinction of being one of the two places in the hegemony where antimatter was produced in militarily useful quantities. The rare and precious substance had been one of the foundations of the old imperial economy, but the secrets of its production, its economical production at least, had been lost in the Great Death. The hegemony had rediscovered the techniques after a sort, and it had begun to adopt antimatter technology in its battle fleets, most specifically in its railgun primary batteries, which used the substance to accelerate the projectiles to the required velocities. The recovery of technology and technique had only been a partial one, however, and antimatter production was vastly more expensive than it had been in Imperial times. The expense of supplying the warships engaged with Rim powers had been heavy, and the need to fuel up Colossus had come a hair's breadth from toppling the entire economy. The fact that the great ship and its staggeringly expensive fuel had been lost, surrendered to the Confederation, only made the whole thing seem like a staggering waste. If the fleet couldn't hold it, if the others took Itara Mordlin, the hegemony would lose half its antimatter production, and with it a substantial part of whatever chance it had of holding on, of driving the enemy back. Pharsalon had a few defensive orbital stations. They would be useful if the fighting came near enough for them to engage. More importantly, Planet 7 was ringed with massive fortresses, A contrast that evidenced Kronos was not the first to realize Farsalon's inhabitants were far from the most precious resource in the system. He'd brought his flagship into orbit around Farsalon. He owed that much to the planetary administrator, and the millions looking on with what had to be growing terror. He would address them all, massage the truth enough to make them believe the fleet had come to protect them. He would lie. Then he would join the rest of his forces farther out in the system. The battle line would be drawn up around Planet 7, just within the range of the massive orbital railguns, the greatest force the hegemony had ever massed in one place, with the exception, perhaps, of Colossus and its supporting fleet, would be waiting for the enemy. Even as he discharged his duties to the doomed masses of Farsalon, his engineering teams were updating the scanner suites on the orbital forts, keying in the most recent targeting routines. The battle would be the first large-scale test of the new programming, the first time massive hegemony firepower would face the other's vessels with at least a chance to hit. Kronos wasn't optimistic, but in a seemingly contradiction he was determined. He didn't know if he could stop the others in Atara Mordlin, but he was damned sure about one thing. The enemy would get one hell of a fight. Admiral, it appears the hegemony have completed their scanner update to the orbital fortresses. Very well, Lieutenant. Baron almost admonished the officer for still thinking of the hegemony as the enemy. It was understandable, even reasonable, but it was also unacceptable given the circumstances. The best chance for the Confederation, the entire Rim, to survive was very likely to fight alongside the hegemony. That meant learning to cooperate, and it damn sure meant getting past calling them the enemy. But Baron let it go. He would push his people, but he wasn't going to be unreasonable. And truth be told, he still thought of the hegemony as the enemy often enough himself. That was something time would change, but he had no idea how long it would take. Or for that matter, how long any of them had. He turned back and stared at the ugly gray and black sphere on the display. The seventh planet was so hideous it almost hurt his eyes to look at it, but he'd instantly known there was something valuable about it when he set eyes on the defense network. Over 100 orbital forts, each one massive and bristling with weapons. The array made the old Megara defenses look like a tiny picket line. Baron had fought before the Confederation's capital, and he had assaulted the legendary defenses of Palatia during the Alliance Civil War. But he'd never seen anything like the massive display of power and might before him. The fixed defenses alone made the system the logical choice to mount a defense, at least if the enemy could be drawn close enough to engage. Then Baron realized that wouldn't be a problem. His mind had raced since he'd first spotted the defenses. Rare minerals, helium-3, tritium, there had to be something on that planet, something valuable enough to justify what had to be an unimaginable cost. Then suddenly he knew. He didn't have the slightest doubt, but he'd ordered a full scanner sweep anyway just to confirm it. And his sensors and probes told him exactly what he already knew. Massive energy readings all across the planet. Atara Mordlin 7 was an antimatter factory, and that made it incalculably, almost unimaginably valuable. That's why we're here. The enemy has to go toward the fixed defenses. They can't ignore an antimatter production center. And Kronos can't give it up either, not without one hell of a fight. Baron felt the resentment again as he realized the antimatter that powered every railgun shot that had torn apart one of his battleships might have come from there. Part of him almost wanted to see the others blast that planet-wide production facility to atoms. But we're going to need that antimatter. Those railguns aren't pointed at your people anymore, and you're going to need antimatter from the hegemony to refuel Colossus. It would take 1,000 years production at Confederation levels to replenish that monster. Admiral, Lena Dor and its escorts have rejoined the main hegemony fleet. Baron's eyes darted back to the display, but it was a pointless gesture. Between his ships and the massive hegemony fleet, there were more than 700 contacts, all represented by symbols so small, the tiny labels next to them were unreadable. It was impossible to pick out Kronos's flagship, at least until the AI highlighted it with a large white star. Baron wasn't sure why Kronos had left the main formation and gone to the inhabited planet, but he had a guess, and he'd have bet a fair amount he was right. There was a decent-sized population on that planet, a couple 100 million or more, Baron suspected. And altogether they weren't a fraction of the strategic asset Planet 7 was. Kronos had gone to reassure the people, to tell them the fleet was there to fight, and he'd done it to assuage the guilt and the feeling of failure he'd feel if there were heavy casualties on the planet. He wondered if it had worked for the hegemony commander. such things never had for him. Admiral, I've got Admiral Travis on your line. Baron activated the comm unit. Dauntless's bridge felt naked without his aide, his comrade, the warrior who had stood at his side almost as long as he could remember. He'd sent her out on an inspection tour to follow up on Jared Sims's work. The lieutenant had reported that all but 12 of the fleet's hulls had been updated, but as much as Baron liked the brilliant young engineer, he'd feel better after Atara confirmed those facts. Atara?
Yes, Admiral. I'm on Formidable. It looks like Sims lived up to his billing. I've run Formidable in Vincennes and Valiant too, through some pretty deep-fire drills. Without actual enemy ships to target, it's hard to be completely sure, but I'm convinced enough. If and when we get the authorization to engage, we'll be ready. As ready as we can be.
That's good to hear. Admiral Baron, we're picking up massive energy readings at the fourth transit point. The officer's voice pulled his mind back to Dauntless's bridge. The entry point Chrono said the enemy would be using. Scanners on full in all capital ships, prepare to launch a spread of long-range probes. We may not be able to fire on whatever comes through there, but we can gather as much information as possible. Baron's head angled forward, and he spoke into the comm unit. Looks like the party's about to get started, Atara. Get back here right away. We may just be spectators, but I'll still feel better with you on Dauntless's bridge.
On my way, Admiral.
Baron cut the line. He sat where he was, twitching in his chair. His stomach was tied up in knots. He had experienced the fear of battle many times, and he never imagined anything else could be as unsettling. But sitting there, his hands tied, watching as a new enemy advanced, it was worse than being in the fight. His mind was racing, tactical analysis, battle plans, but in the end there was just one thought that was even remotely useful. Good luck, Kronos. Ilias stood on Anthrocles Bridge. He'd come from his sanctum, the hard servant of duty that lived inside him, overcoming the doubt and fear that had come close to paralyzing him. He could hide in his private space while the fleet was hurtling from one system to another, but the instant he'd heard the report of enemy ships pouring through the tube, he'd leapt to his feet. He knew his place, where he had to be. With any luck, none of the bridge crew would be able to see just how close he'd come to breaking. He'd attack the fear the way he did every problem, applying his considerable intellect to analyzing the cause. He'd faced death before, and however powerful the others might be, however mysterious their technology and motives, dying was dying. There was no cause to fear meeting his end from the others' mysterious blue beams any more than a Confederation bomber assault. Then he'd realized. It wasn't fear of death, at least no more than he'd felt before in other combat situations. He was struggling with being outclassed, outmatched, and outgunned by the enemy. Ilias had long sided with Kronos and the rest of the fringe minority of the hegemony's master class, warning about the dangers of arrogance. But only then did he truly understand how much he himself had fallen prey to that deadly hubris. He'd never been in a battle where the hegemony wasn't the superior force, and he found it difficult, if not impossible, to adapt his thinking, to accept that his people were the underdogs in this fight. It was fear, after a fashion, but it was more complex than just simple terror. The realization of what was haunting him had been the first step to purging himself of it, or at least gaining control over it. Still, he knew it would be a long struggle to adapt, to become the best warrior he could be in the changed dynamic. Unless the others killed him in the next hours, there would be a twisted sort of mercy in that. All fleet units report full combat readiness, Commander.
Very well.
Ilias commanded the force unceremoniously dubbed Fleet Beta. He and Kronos had divided the available vessels, all together better than two-thirds of all the hegemony's forces, and each commanded one component. Kronos had the larger force, the equally casually named Fleet Alpha. The ships of Alpha, just over 60% of the hegemony vessels in the system, were deployed forward. Kronos, facing the others for the first time, would bear the brunt of the initial assault. Ilias, supposedly with more experience facing the enemy, was positioned behind, with orders to move forward on whatever vector he believed best. It was a straightforward battle plan and one that made perfect sense, at least against any other enemy. But Ilias knew just how hard the enemy would hit Kronos' ships. He wouldn't really have time to wait for an opportunity, to play for time until he could manage a flanking maneuver. In the black pit of his mind, he knew he would be compelled to push forward in a desperate attempt to support Kronos' beleaguered fleet sooner rather than later, and that his ships would follow their comrades into the maelstrom. Ilias had never gone into a battle so certain of defeat.
Fighter Command, I want all squadrons ready for immediate launch.
Yes, Commander.
Ilias had all of the 14 battleships in the fleet that had been retrofitted to carry small attack craft. The Hegemony's program of fighter deployment had been a response to the devastating effects of the Rim squadrons, and it had been heavily based on Colossus. The handful of battleships carried 2 squadrons each, a minute force compared to the massive wings the Rim dwellers had sent in on their desperate attacks. Worse, perhaps, the Hegemony forces had been designed to face Rim bombers, so they were outfitted as interceptors. The Hegemony ships lacked the modular designs that allowed the Rim craft to convert to bomber kits. The Hegemony engineers, working hastily in the time since the others had appeared, had managed to come up with externally mounted torpedoes. But they were far less accurate than their Rim equivalents, and they carried smaller payloads as well. The Kriegery flyers piloting them had been trained to take their ships in close, very close, and a culture of self-sacrifice had grown up around the fledgling corps, at least in theory. None of the pilots had actually been compelled to make good on that mantra. Ilias would send them out when he judged the time to be right, and he wondered how many, if any, would return. He wondered with even greater urgency if the minuscule force would make a difference, if the small craft would prove as useful an asset to the Hegemony as they had been a threat out on the Rim. He'd seen relatively modest confed bomber wings do devastating damage to Hegemony ships of the line. But those were bombers, not fighters carrying a jury-rigged torpedo, and the Rim has a long tradition of small craft operations. The Kriegery learned quickly, but Ilias knew it was unreasonable to expect them to perform at the same level as their former enemies. And the fledgling Hegemony fighter corps had yet to produce a standout leader, and certainly no one remotely comparable to the Confederation's Jake Stockton. "Commander, the enemy are—" "Yes, Killaron, I see." Ilias stared straight ahead, watching as the huge screen in the forward of the control center lit up, dozens of flashes moving across the empty space. The enemy had opened fire on Kronos' line. Chapter 29. Sector 9 Safe House. Just outside the lethal zone. Liberté City. Planet Montmorel, Gassara 4. Union Year 225, 321 AC.
"I don't care how severe his injuries are, Doctor. This is the first citizen. His life is the most important thing in the Union right now."
Gravis Steves narrowed his eyes, and his voice deepened.
"Important enough that yours now depends on his."
The doctor stared back, a look of pure fear on his face. The day had been a difficult one all around, and Steves knew the doctor had been working since the night before, trying to aid the thousands of wounded staggering around in the streets. There was no explanation as to what happened, not yet at least, no public announcements, or secret communiques to which he was privy. All he was sure of was that it had been unauthorized. It wasn't that Villeneuve wouldn't order a nuclear detonation in the city if it served his purposes, but the first citizen damn sure would have made arrangements to be out of the blast radius. As it was, the only reason Villeneuve was alive was that he'd decided to leave early and return to his villa. He'd had a headache or something, a minor malady that had saved his life. Maybe. That left what had happened firmly in the category of unsolved mysteries. Steves spent a lot of time analyzing threats to the Union, and to the first citizen in particular. But he was at a loss for what had caused a fission explosion in the middle of Liberté City. Steves had been on alert for months now, ever since the failed coup attempt. He'd played a central role in the particularly effective bit of espionage and security work that had warned the first citizen just in time, and Gaston Villeneuve had proven his gratitude, both in promotions and power, and in vast awards of currency as well. Steves's loyalty to his superior was based somewhat on that, but truth be told, he was as much a product of the Union system as Villeneuve himself. His first thought had been to let the first citizen die, to open up a power vacuum and try to seize a higher position for himself. His true concern for Villeneuve only came after he'd determined that he wasn't high enough yet not to make a play for the first citizen's chair. And if anyone else took that sought-after seat, his future would depend almost solely on how the new dictator decided to treat the key aides of the former one. History did not offer many signs of hope in that regard. So his future was best served, best secured, by Villeneuve's continued control over the government. He had done all he could to keep things from getting out of hand, sent out dispatches that the first citizen had been injured, but not badly, that he would be back at his desk in a day or two. Lies like that could buy time, a little. But now he had to see that Villeneuve actually survived, and one look at his battered form, the clearly broken bones and dislocated shoulder, the hideous burns down one side of his body, didn't give him all that much cause for hope. And that doesn't even factor in radiation, for yourself either. Steve's had escaped major injury. He'd almost forgotten the dozen or so painful cuts and scrapes covering his body. But he knew that wasn't his only concern. Both he and Villeneuve had gotten heavy hits of radiation. He didn't have much doubt about that. He hadn't felt any symptoms yet, somewhat to his surprise, but he was sure it was only a matter of time. It was probably nothing a good cleanse couldn't clear out, but that required a major medical center, and he hadn't come up with a way to get Villeneuve there in secret. He had half a dozen guards with him, all of whom he considered reliable, but he needed to round up more force, and he had to get Villeneuve to a hospital. And he had to keep things quiet. If word got out about the First Citizen's true condition, the knives would be drawn in hours, and high-level functionaries all over Montmorat would begin making their moves to seize power. Fear of Villeneuve was a potent deterrent, but it only worked if people believed the man was alert and in charge. And if the power struggle began in earnest, every prime mover would send assassins to finish Villeneuve off. That would be the end for Steve's, too. Loyalty in the Union was a strange beast, usually self-serving and not very idealistic. But it worked much the same as it did anywhere, and regardless of his reasons, Gravis Steeves would protect the First Citizen. With all his strength, whatever it took. He pressed his hand against his jacket, feeling the holstered sidearm under his shoulder. The coat was torn in half a dozen places, but it was still hiding the pistol. Steeves had grabbed the weapon on his way out, almost on instinct, but that reflexive move hadn't extended to grabbing any reloads. The weapon held 20 shots, and if and when he'd gone through those, and sooner or later he knew, looking at the chaos all around, he would use them, he'd be reduced to fending off enemies with a rock or a club. That's a problem for later. I've got 20 shots before I get to that. He turned and looked back, watching the doctor. In effect, his hostage, working feverishly to save Gaston Villeneuve. And probably to save Gravis Steeves as well. What the hell happened? Kurevsky heard the words. He had heard almost nothing but questions of that sort since the explosion had shattered every window in the embassy and fried a fair amount of its electronic systems as well. He had the defensive contingent, all of 34 Marines, positioned all around, keeping watch on the mobs growing throughout the city with alarming speed. It was mostly a gesture, something to keep the embassy staff as calm as possible. There were hundreds of thousands in the streets, perhaps millions. If they got fired up to storm the compound, a handful of Marines weren't going to stop them, even if Kurevsky authorized them to gun down Union citizens. He'd wondered what had happened himself, for a few minutes at least. If the explosion had occurred anywhere else, he might still be trying to figure it out. But he knew Sandrine Ciara well enough not to underestimate her. She'd played him, at least with regard to her intent to try to shoot Gaston Villeneuve. She'd done what he'd asked, after a fashion. He didn't know for sure if Villeneuve was alive or dead, but there was a damn good chance the Union dictator had died in the blast. Ciara had just changed the plan they'd discussed, tried something that offered rather more chance of success, albeit at a considerable cost and collateral damage. Was she really willing to kill so many people just to? His mind stopped cold. No, it wasn't just a high-percentage way to strike at Villeneuve. She wanted more than her enemy's death. She wanted the chaos, the mad fury in the streets. She was making another play for power, and this time she was moving into a void, one of her own creation, and not up against an entrenched dictator who was waiting for her. If she survived the explosion... He'd done the math half a dozen times. He'd been estimating, guessing, how long it took her to reach her objective. The reactor under the Hall of the People, that has to be it. Then the time to sabotage the system and to escape. He'd analyzed it every way he could, and the best he could come up with was a very narrow escape, if everything had gone perfectly. If something, anything, had delayed her, she was most likely dead out there on the street, one of thousands of corpses still lying ungathered. He'd felt the urge to go looking for her, but he quickly realized that was impossible. He'd never get close, and if he tried to move out in any force, he'd almost certainly trigger a violent attack from the mob. As much as he was concerned for her, despite the fact that she'd lied to him, the last thing he could do was tie the Confederation to an assassination attempt, and worse, to a calamity that had claimed thousands of lives. He turned abruptly. He had to find out what had happened, and if Ciara was still alive. But first he had duties as the Confederation ambassador. Guile, he called for his aide. Sir, the diplomatic assistant, and in his lesser-known role, Confederation agent, poked his head around the corner.
We have to put together a statement of sympathy and offer the Union government any assistance we are able to provide, and try to find out if there is a Union government right now.
Yes, Ambassador, I will draft something immediately and bring it to you for approval.
Very well. A pause. Make it sound heartfelt.
He wasn't sure it would matter, but from the looks of the crowd, anything that might diffuse anger against the Confederation was worth a try.
The air was thick with dust, and every breath triggered a fresh coughing fit. Ciara stumbled forward, gritting her teeth against the pain. Her arm was broken, she was sure of that, but she had managed to pinpoint the pain in her back. She'd almost panicked in those first terrifying moments when she'd awakened. She'd been afraid she'd broken her spine, but somehow she'd managed to get up and move around, slowly and painfully, but without significant impairment. In the end, her timing had been close to spot on. She'd gotten as far as she could, and when she guessed the countdown was under 1 minute, she frantically searched for some kind of shelter. She was far enough away, she bet, that whatever building she was in wouldn't come down on her, so she chose the sturdiest structure close to her and dove inside. Her guess had proven partially correct. The building as a whole still stood, but a large section of wall had caved in, coming perilously close to burying her under the rubble. She'd crawled out and made her way into the street, and something that felt like 2 hours of walking had gotten her out of the fringes of the blast zone, though not away from the chaos, which seemed to have spread throughout the city. All she wanted was to rest, to close her eyes and sleep. But that wasn't a possibility. First, she needed some medical assistance. Her arm was an inconvenience, a painful one, but the worst problem, she suspected, was radiation. She had no idea how much protection the building had offered her, but the growing turmoil in her stomach suggested she hadn't entirely escaped the unseen effects of the dirty explosion. Even more importantly, she had a very limited time to make her bid for power. She was assuming Villeneuve was dead, of course, though she had no way to verify it. Still, even without her primary adversary in the picture, she knew she had to get a foothold before word got out that the first citizen was dead. Once the secret spread, every fleet admiral and high government official would be evaluating his or her chances to seize the top position. Ciara wasn't scared of a good fight, not usually, but her own resources were scarce at the moment, and she had almost no preparations in place. Too many of her contacts, her potential allies, had been rounded up after the coup attempt, and many of them had died for their involvement in her plot. She could entice new ones, of course, gather confused mid-level officials to support her efforts, but it wouldn't be easy. She would gain those the old-fashioned way. She would promise them more than her rivals did, and she would convince them she had a chance at success. That last bit would be the hardest part. Giving away prospective officers and cash awards were simple enough things to do, but presenting her dirty, disheveled, injured self as a real contender for power was going to be a challenge. She thought about Karevsky, wondered how angry he would be that she deviated from the plan so aggressively. She thought she could probably entice him back to her corner, though she was in no shape for a seduction, so that couldn't be part of the plan. Perhaps more enthusiastic assurances of a lasting peace between the Confederation and the Union. Villeneuve had been nearly obsessed with defeating the Union's neighbor, but Ciara was more than willing to enforce a peace, and even ally with, the Confederation, if that was the price of the help she needed. But there were other problems. The embassy would be the center of attention,